podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, hello, here we go, it's the Copyright Podcast.
Hello everyone and welcome back to the Copyright Podcast. I'm Mitch Moran and I'm joined once again by Jay Pearson. How are you doing, Jay?
Good, mate.
Good stuff. But doesn't matter about Jay today, we've got a special guest on. It's former Evening Standard and now freelance journalist David Lynch. How are you doing, Dave? Are you okay?
Yeah, good. Glad to be back, lad. It's nice to be back on here.
Yeah, it's been a long time since June.
We're in the depths of lockdown then, so it's life got a little bit better and then worse again now, so that's nice.
Yeah, we've all got better haircuts now as well, haven't we, Jay?
Yeah.
I like the lighting. It just the lights are bouncing off me. It's a nice little shine, you know. I had my haircut for my birthday for tomorrow, so I'm ready to go.
Oh, nice.
Anyway, we'll crack on, and obviously Liverpool beat Sheffield United on the weekend 2-1. But unfortunately, VAR rears its ugly head once again. So that's where we're going to start off, really. Obviously, we go 1-0 down through a Fabinho foul on the edge of the box. For me, I thought it was a bit of a, not a silly tackle, but he's asking to be punished a little bit, isn't he, in terms of the tackle. But when you watch it back on the replay and stuff like that, he's clearly got the ball. And then you look at stuff like the Man United game where Harry Maguire's nearly taken Azpilicueta's head off and you're like, where's the consistency in it? Like, I don't understand. There's no clear definition anymore, is there, Dave?
No, that's it. I think you're right to mention that it was sort of a bit of a silly challenge, because I remember seeing just in the immediate aftermath of what we thought was a free kick being given was Jordan Henderson basically having a pop at Fabinho. I'm guessing sort of saying, why are you going to ground there? Obviously, the clearance he tried to make before, it was a bit of an error in itself, and then he's compounded his error by going to ground. So I think that's something you wouldn't have seen Virgil van Dijk do. He just stood him up and tried to sort of force the play away. So I think, he gave the referee a decision to make in that sense. But the decision itself is just absolutely crackers. I think that's a clear example of someone winning the ball and getting a bit of a man after. But I don't think you call that a foul anywhere else on the pitch. I think because the referee has given the foul, the tendency for the VAR is to sort of try and back that decision up and not overturn it unless it's extremely clear, even though I thought this was a clear example of sort of not really a foul. And then obviously they have to give a penalty in that case then, because by the definition of the law, he's on the line, so it's in the box. So, you can't argue with him actually giving a penalty. It's just very unfortunate that's considered a foul. I think, we got conflicting reports as well in the immediate aftermath about whether or not they'd actually checked the foul itself rather than where it was on the pitch. So that adds to the frustration, and that's the exact same thing that happened after the Everton game, was conflicting reports coming out about what exactly had been looked at and what hadn't. So that doesn't really help things, doesn't make things clearer or give people sort of any faith in the system at all. So it's so frustrating, the situation we've got at the moment.
Yeah, and like I watched that thing on Sky Sports News, Ref Watch, where they have like referees on, like Dermot Gallagher. And it's like Stephen Warnock's on there and he's just like, you can see his face, he's like just perplexed. Like, so Dermot Gallagher says, the referee's given a foul, VAR has checked whether it was in the box or not, and because they've adjudged it was in the box, they've given a pen. So you can see that you can check whether it's in the box. It's like the Pickford thing, they've checked that it's offside. So why can't they then check to see if it's offside in the Pickford instance or if it's a foul or not? There's no clear definition of like what are they looking at on VAR? Are they looking at just segments of it, or are they looking at it all? It is baffling, isn't it?
Well, I don't understand. They're not just looking at things that are recommended to them to look at, because obviously they're trying to overturn anything the referee has missed is the idea of it. So it's not like, oh, well, I can't look at that because the referee's not asked me to look at it. It's just a case of look at everything that happens, and if you see any infringement in there or anything that doesn't get spotted by the ref, then you use the technology to overturn it. And if that's correct, that they didn't actually check the foul or not, because some people have said that they did. I know the couple of reports at the time was that they didn't check the actual foul itself, but some they've since sort of claimed that they did. So I can't be definitive on that, I suppose, but I just don't think the correct decision was made. I think a lot of people would agree with that. Great to sort of, in the sense of the penalty call was absolutely bang on. You've got to say VAR worked in that sense, particularly for Sheffield United. You know, they would have been denied a penalty in that sense. But it's just not worked in the sense of judging whether it's a foul or not. It's just really hard to get your head around. And I do just wish there was some sort of, you know, I watch ref watch, quite a lot myself. And it's, you know, it's great to see that analysis of the decisions. But if there was an official explanation of the week's most controversial decisions sort of stitched into that somewhat, it would sort of make things, I think, a little bit easier to accept.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, it's, you can see when Stephen Warnock's having a bit of a pop that Dermot Gallagher's just kind of smiling because he knows he's got to be official on telly and he's got to give, like, the letter of, like, the officialness of what's been given. But really, he must have his own opinion that these decisions that are getting made are clearly, one, wrong, and two, should be then looked at and corrected. Because if we then go on to lose that game or draw it, it's made into a massive thing. It's just lucky that we got over the line, isn't it, really?
Yeah, and the scariest thing about it, I think, is the fact that if you were the VAR ref going into that game and you knew what had happened with Liverpool the week before, you'd be like, right, I need to be absolutely on it today. Like, I can't miss anything. I can't have any high-profile gaffes here. I'm going to watch everything to the minutiae of every situation to make sure I don't miss a thing. And then, bang, first half, there's just a horrendous error that leads to a penalty that could have changed the outcome of the game. It's just incredible. I don't look forward to seeing what it's like when they're not completely on it going into, you know, maybe a couple of weeks down the line when the furore is died down around all this. You know, what are they still going to be like then? Is there going to be even worse calls? It's just madness.
Sorry, mate.
I was just about to say, for me, I was sat there ready to watch that game and I thought, right, last week's done now. Let's put it behind us. We've got another league game right in front of us now. Let's just move on from it. There's nothing we can do to change it. And like I said, within the first half an hour, we've got another dodgy decision. And I just think, for God's sake, is there, like, you know, there's not an agenda against or anything like that. It's just the way that the world works at the minute. But it's just that whole millimetres again, you know, the 11 millimetres of the goal line technology at the Etihad. And then it's this again. And I just think we can't catch a break at the minute. And it was really pissing me off, to speak frankly, because I just thought there's no consistency because it's still controlled by a human being. Everyone still has that different level of what they think at the end of the day, because not every referee has the same opinion as the next one, do they? And that's where it needs to change, because the technology's fine, it's there, but it's the people that are controlling it that really need to be on a level playing field. And everyone needs to decide, well, yes, that is or that isn't. You know, take a panel of 100 refs or whatever and go, right, what's your opinion on this margin? Yeah, I agree it should be, and take a majority vote.
Yeah,
and those subjective decisions are the ones that are going to be really difficult, it seems, to sort of get any sort of consensus on, because I just think, you know, it seems to, I'm not really sure what's influencing the decision at that point. I just don't, you know, that, I think even, you know, even in subjective terms, you look at that foul, and it's, you know, at best it's extremely weak that to give a penalty for. I just think, you know, it's just surprising to me that it didn't get overturned, basically, if it was looked at, because I just think, you know, how many people would you show that to and they would say it's a penalty or even a foul if it was, say, outside the box? I just think very, very few. I don't think it's a Liverpool fan thing, or, you know, was looking at it favourably from their point of view. I really just think that's it's just not a lot in it at all. And the fact that it's gone to VAR and they've looked at it and come up with that, it's just really, really surprising. And I honestly don't know how you solve that issue, to be honest.
Yeah, and I mean, if they've started doing where they go over to the monitor and have a look themselves, might have even been an option. Like, not every free kick, because that would just slow it right down, but, like, penalty decisions where, like, it could really affect the game, we could lose the game because of it, just go and take 15 seconds, 30 seconds if you want, and have a look.
100% on that is that maybe because it got upgraded from a free kick to a penalty, Mike Dean maybe felt he didn't need to go and see it. Well, maybe the VAR's role in that situation is say, this should be upgraded to a penalty because it's just on the line, it's inside the box. Maybe you want to go and have another look at the foul. And I think that, because I think if Mike Dean goes and looks at it and the second time he sees it, he still thinks it's a foul, I think you sort of hold your hands up and say, do you know what, the referee, it's probably easier to take if the referee who's refereeing the game rather than a man in a studio miles away sort of makes that call on the foul itself. You know, if it is down to that one man, you just take it in the way that you have you know, all the years prior to VAR even being introduced. So I think that would have made it easy to say. I think that's a good call, actually, is maybe whenever it does come down to a penalty in that way, go, you know, do go and have a look at it.
Yeah, because if they're banking on the reliability of the fella in the booth wherever he is, Stockley Park, and if he's not saying to the referee, you need to go and have a look at this, then the referee is going to take that as read, that he doesn't need to go and take a look at it, that he thinks by process elimination that he's made the right call, and it's not working at the moment, is it? Like I said, with the Harry Maguire one, like Dermot Gallagher saying it's definitely a penalty, and it's like a stone cold stunner. That, like, what's he doing?
It's another one of those. If you showed it to 100 people, how many people would say it's not a penalty? But, you know, very, very few, and they would be Man United fans, I think, the ones who'd say it. So it's just crazy, really, that we've got this technology now, and then we still seem to be coming out with some absolutely shocking decisions.
Yeah, and it feds into the next point, really. It's like, I read the stats after Everton obviously lost to 2-0 to Southampton. It's the first time since 1967-68 that all English clubs are unbeaten through the first six matches. Have I read that right? I haven't read that right, have I? It's the first time since 67-68 in which no sides are unbeaten in the first six games. So everyone's lost, and that's the first time for that long. So that obviously points to VAR, doesn't it, clearly?
Yeah, I think VAR is a leveler. I think the crowd situation is probably playing a role in that. Yeah. The fact that the fans in, I think that's possibly, you know, I think that it was actually noticeable, I thought, in the Sheffield United game. There was periods in that game, and a particular period in the second half, where I was sort of sat back and I was like, what is going on here? This is so sort of sedate, the pace, and the way the players were moving just didn't look right. You know, particularly it was probably around 70 minutes or so, and you think, okay, maybe they're losing a bit of energy at this point, but you wouldn't notice that generally when you're watching the match and there's fans in, because that extra crowd energy and that sort of feeds to the players. And that did sort of seem to be weird. And then, yeah, you've got the weirdness of VAR giving these, you know, particularly early in the season where you had situations with some absolutely ludicrous handballs, this new offside thing that sort of, you know, has really changed things in terms of the sleeve playing you offside or onside or whatever. So it's a weird, weird season. I think that's probably contributed to that statistic.
Yeah, and it's another one where, like you said, the change in the rules as the season's going on. So at the beginning of the season, the handballs, it was like if it hits the hand and it's just in the area, it's a penalty. And now because of the furore around that, they've now changed it. So surely the fact that they know that these decisions are happening at the minute are all wrong, and general, it's not like it's not a favourable thing from Liverpool fans saying it's wrong because we're Liverpool fans. It's like you said, most 90% of people would say that the decisions are wrong. So I hope that would something like that happen in terms of, like you said, like trying to fix that up as the season progresses.
You would hope so, wouldn't you? Because I think, you know, we've seen it with the handball that you've got to say that they have actually improved that situation. I think the Andy Robertson one that happens against Sheffield United, that would have been a penalty if it was the first week of the season, which is absolutely ridiculous. You know, he knew nothing about it. He's just running and it hits his hand at pace. So, you know, they have shown a willingness to sort of fix things. You know, whether they can sort some of these other issues, I don't know. You would really hope so, because, you know, the handball was such an obvious problem. We were on for, like, you know, 10 times the record of penalties in a season if that had carried on. So, yeah, hopefully they can sort of make some minor changes. And so, you know, because I think with the whole VAR thing, it is a sort of process of working through it and trying to improve it, because these laws weren't written with the idea that you were going to go and watch all the incidents that happen in a football match back again in slow-mo. So it's, you know, the laws have got to adapt to the technology almost. We've got to sort of catch up, and that's that situation. I think they shouldn't be scared of doing that as the season progresses, because we're learning all the time about how particular laws should be applied in these new circumstances.
I think one of the things for me where I echo what you just said with your stat there, Mick, about the teams, you know, everyone's been beaten so far in the season. The whole positive I take from this is the fact that, obviously, given what happened at Goodison, obviously the incident against Sheffield, we're still at the top of the league. And I just think, well, do you know what? If that's happening now, and given everything that's happened so far in this crazy little season, I'm just so grateful that we're still there already. And we are, you know, a good points total clear of the likes of City, who we all expected to be the front runners, didn't we, Dave?
Yeah, I think it's good to sort of, you know, you don't want to be having to play catch up at any point. The fact that Liverpool have, you know, like you say, despite all the sort of setbacks and the weirdness and getting absolutely thrashed by Aston Villa, are still, you know, joint top of the table at the moment. It's sort of testament to the fact that I think regardless of what this season throws at Liverpool, they'll be up there in terms of challenging for the title, that's for sure. I think, you know, watching City have their early struggles, which, you know, you can make excuses for, and they're 100%, you know, they've had a lot of issues to deal with in terms of, like, the late start to the season and things like that. And, you know, as much as anyone there, you know, dealing with these crowd and the VAR issues, and that Liverpool have sort of just taken that on board and seem to be just a bit of a machine and still grinding out the wins, and even when they don't play well, is hugely encouraging. I think, you know, I wrote a piece... unfortunate timing on my part, actually wrote a piece just before the Aston Villa game saying I couldn't really understand why Liverpool weren't being made favourites for the league. Obviously, after the sort of that week sort of jumped into the position of favourites and then just got absolutely battered and sort of dropped off a little bit. But I still, you know, I stand by that, you know, and I stood by that even by after the Aston Villa game, because I thought it was a bit of a freak situation. Because I think they've got the strongest squad. Me, you know, that's been massively weakened, to be honest, in terms of losing Virgil van Dijk. I still think that the general strength across the squad in a lot of positions, except maybe centre-half, is probably stronger than City on paper. And I think you've got a manager who is, you know, I think you can say in the last couple of years has been the best manager in the league. And I just think they're really, really well positioned to win the league again this season. I think if City are going to carry on, the uncertainty around Pep Guardiola's situation, Aguero's increasing injury problems, particularly in a season that's compressed like this. I think they've not replaced Sané properly. You know, I think they've got issues to face. I think they've still got issues at centre-half, and he's seemingly, in trying to sort of solve that problem at the moment, have struggled to create as many chances as they used to. So yeah, I still think Liverpool, the way they've coped with it is hugely encouraging, and what a good start it's been despite that Villa result.
Yeah, and I think Liverpool are always going to be written off, and especially maybe now that we've lost Van Dijk, people might be maybe making us sort of lesser favourites. What I'm happy with, like, if you write Liverpool off at your peril, I say, especially on the Jurgen Klopp, like, there's no reason why we can't win the Premier League and Champions League. Like, if you have any lesser ambitions than that, then what's the point in even trying? Like, we're still an absolute, like you said, Dave, an absolute force. Fabinho has been exemplary back in centre-back. We've still got Mata to come back in. There's still loads of positives, and maybe look at January for San. So there's definitely loads of positives. But in terms of moving forwards, but obviously we won the Sheffield United game, thank fuck. But yeah, there was no blowback from that. And we go and play Midtjylland tomorrow. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Probably not. But yeah, they lost 4-0 last week to Atalanta. So let's hope for a similar scoreline for us. Do you expect many changes to the lineup, Dave? I know there's no Thiago, no Matip, no Keita. Maybe Curtis Jones or Milner might come in again after the outing against Ajax last week.
Yeah, the problem is in terms of rotation is in midfield at the moment, obviously not, you know, with Thiago not being in, Keita not being in, that's, you know, you're a bit short on options there. You know, even at fullback where you might like to make a change, like Tsimikas coming in for this one. He's not available, which is a shame, you know, because you've got to admit, it's one of the easier sort of group games. I think even Jurgen Klopp would acknowledge that privately. It's one of the one you would expect to be more straightforward. So it would have been an opportunity for rotation, but I just think the injuries have sort of caused him problems in terms of looking to do that. You know, he might look to sort of maybe mix things up in terms of taking out one of the front three and sort of giving Jota another start there with a mind to sort of working his way through these coming games. Curtis Jones, I know he wasn't sort of seen in the video at training today, but my understanding is he is fit and he will be in the squad tomorrow. So whether that means maybe a start, because it was a shame at Ajax, I thought, really, that he was thrown into that and he couldn't really get into the game. It's a tough one, Ajax away, isn't it? To be thrown into that. They're a very dangerous team, even if they're not quite at Liverpool's level. So, you know, a game like this at home to Midtjylland, a weaker team, would maybe be ideal for him, especially if you haven't got those rotational options. I think, you know, maybe give him a chance in this one. I'd quite like to see that. I know that. But, you know, knowing Jurgen Klopp, I'm sure he'll sort of... Well, it's a tough one, isn't it? He doesn't like to do too much rotating, but I think he just knows what this schedule is like this season. He's going to have to make some difficult decisions, I think, and maybe in that midfield is where he does something like that, a little bit of a surprise move, and does maybe throw in a Jones or someone like that.
Yeah, and I think when you look back at his two previous games, Curtis Jones in the cup games, before the Ajax games, he was really good, and I think he put a bit too much pressure on himself, didn't he, in the Ajax game? You could see he was trying to do give and goes, one twos that weren't really on. He was trying to force a little bit. I think that's why he came off in the end, didn't he? But yeah, like you said, I think it's a perfect game for him. Do you think anyone like a Reece Williams might start centre half maybe, and then give Fabinho back into midfield?
An interesting one. You know, is that level of trust there with Reece Williams? I know that, you know, obviously he's been thrust sort of back into the limelight in terms of the squad. And throwing him on at Ajax, that wasn't, I suppose, a token move. I don't think Jurgen Klopp just dishes out. He said it before, isn't he? He just dish appearances out, just like presents. He'll give them to people who deserve them. So obviously, Williams has impressed him in training enough to earn that. I suppose, you know, taking that next step to start the Champions League game is a big ask. I know, you know, he hasn't got a lot of options, but, you know, you'd hope that Matip isn't too far away. So, it just looks a big risk to me, that one. You know, in the centre of defence, putting Curtis Jones in as a sort of 10/8 position is perhaps less risky than throwing in a teenager at centre-half. So, it's possible. It's possible, but I think it's one I'd maybe say it's sort of tough to see at the moment. And if he did, what a great moment that'd be for Reece Williams. But it's just a tough one to see. I think he's just going to try and get that Fabinho Gomez partnership going again. Just try and keep that steady, because I think in theory as well, centre halves don't do maybe as much running, do they, in matches, or shouldn't be doing. So he does have a tendency to try and build those partnerships and keep it going. So I think he might just stick with those two at the centre defence.
Yeah, I think we both said it earlier, didn't we, Jay? Like, it makes sense that have those two building that partnership, as, like you said, like Klopp said today, that he wants those parts to be built, and Trent getting used to playing with Fabinho, and Gomez to get used to playing with him, Robbo, just the whole system, so it's more systematic in terms of, because we're so used to seeing Virgil van Dijk, Gomez, Trent and Robbo. When you take one of those pieces out, and such a huge piece like Virgil van Dijk, it's obviously going to have a domino effect in terms of the system of Klopp and how we are as a unit, basically. In terms of, like, going forward then, for West Ham on Saturday, do you expect Thiago, Matip and Keita to be back for that one?
I don't know about Matip and Keita. So my latest info on Thiago is that basically being very cautious with him. It was just a case of, you know, he went for that scan. They were really concerned about that initially, but it's just sort of heavy bruising. And, you know, I was told that he was sort of doing some light training. So I think there's a possibility of minutes against West Ham, which will be a major boost, and then, you know, getting him ready then for that big double header, which is Atalanta and then Man City before the international break. So he's not supposed to be far off at all, which is a big boost. I'm not sure about Matip and Keita, to be honest. I'm not entirely sure what his issue is, to be honest. He has had muscular issues in the past, we know that. So, you know, if it's anything like that, they'll take that slowly. And Matip again, I'm not sure where sort of he's up to. You know, whether they are just sort of trying to save him to keep him ready for the Atlanta Man City games. I'm not entirely sure where those two are up to. You know, Matip getting him back would be particularly a big boost, I think, just to have those defensive options, because, you know, we've seen Gomez has picked up injuries in the past himself. So, you know, you just want that sort of safety net there, because you don't want to be putting too much pressure on Reece Williams whenever you use him, I suppose. So, yeah, hopefully those two are not far away, but I know Thiago isn't far off.
Yeah, and I think, like you said, it's not worth risking, like, Midtjylland at home and West Ham at home, really, without those three players, even in the squad, we should still be okay, shouldn't we? Like, we want them back for the Atalanta game away, Man City away, and then we've obviously got Leicester as well, I think, after an international break at home. So the games are going to be coming thick and fast, aren't they? So it makes sense that they're on the side of caution in terms of that, especially Thiago and Matip.
Yeah.
Well, and Keita as well, really, because between Matip and Keita, like I said, they haven't been great injury-wise, and Thiago's only recently came to the club, so it is probably best to err on the side of the caution. Err on the side of caution, there, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. I think in his head, as soon as this sort of injury happened with Thiago, he'd been thinking about Man City away. I think that's somewhere he'd 100% would want to start him, because you want to sort of keep hold of the ball. You need to be press resistant in the middle, and he's he's already, some of the performances, well, the two performances he's put in so far for Liverpool have just been absolutely outstanding, like genuinely sort of just incredible in terms of his ability on the ball and moving it around and just his little burst of pace to get away from players that he has. Something I maybe didn't know about him as much is that little dribble to make space, and he pops the ball off and he can play any pass. So, yeah, I think going into City away, you want your strongest team, and I think Thiago is already making a case that he would be in that. So, and again, Atalanta away, that's another one. You need to keep the ball away from them. They're so dangerous on the break. So many, so much quality there. So, I think getting him ready to sort of start those two games back to back is sort of the plan here, which will be a huge boost for Liverpool. Obviously, two big games to get through before that. They're always big games, but I think if you could get Thiago back for those two, that would be absolutely massive.
Yeah, definitely. Like we've got to make sure, like you said, those performances Thiago's been putting in. It's like you're clapping 5-yard passes just because the way he passes the ball. It's just, he's unbelievable, isn't he? I just wanted to ask you, Dave, about before we move on a little bit, and we've got some questions from some of our Twitter followers about Harvey Elliott, because he's gone out on loan to Blackburn, and I asked you about this back in June when you were last on the pod, and he got a goal and assist in his last game in a 4-0 win over Coventry. It is mad to think that he's still 17. Like I know he's absolutely boss, I love him, but 17 years old, going to the Championship, already scoring goals, getting assists, and I think he had like six big chances on the weekend, and being in the Championship team of the week. Like, do you expect him to come back next season and have a bigger part in the squad?
Yeah, I think Liverpool sort of consider. I've written this, and just after he went to Blackburn on loan, was that Liverpool had no plans to loan him out really until it became apparent that Shaqiri was going to stick around, and he couldn't get a move away. So at that point, it sort of made no sense for him to sort of just sit on the bench, and then Blackburn sensed an opportunity and came in from late. And because of Tony Mowbray's sort of track record of developing youngsters, Liverpool were very keen on it. Plus the fact it was quite close, so they could keep an eye on him. It wasn't a big ask for him to make the move there. So I think it was just sensible, and the timing was perfect. And, I had a few replies on Twitter when I tweeted out the news that he was going to go. People sort of downhearted about it, as if, there's this curse where young players go out on loan and then they never come back into the Liverpool first team. But, couldn't be more different, the situation. The fact that the Championship teams, obviously, it's a typically physical league, want a 17-year-old on loan is, I think, and this is Blackburn as well, a team who sort of would want to put themselves in a promotion chase, certainly sort of play off that sort of area of the table. I just says everything about how good he is, and I've watched the highlights from that performance against Coventry. It was absolutely incredible. He's such a huge talent. I think if he has a season there, a full season there, comes back, he's 100% going to be ready to take Shaqiri's place in the squad. He's a major talent. I think from the first time I saw him, which I think was at was it Oldham in the EFL Trophy game, and he scored. And I just remember thinking then, this lad's going to play for Liverpool in the first team regularly. I just think he's a fantastic talent, and I've got absolutely no worries about the fact that he'll learn a lot while he's on loan at Blackburn, and then he'll come back and play a big role because he'll be ready.
Yeah, and it's when you see him, he's playing on the right of a three, so it's perfect for him to get used to that role, isn't it? Like, we know he can play anywhere, or probably in the front three, but you can see he's just got that class, hasn't he? Like, on the ball, it is like Thiago-like. I'm not comparing him to Thiago, but it's Thiago-like in terms of how he glides on the ball, and the way to pass, and the eye for a pass, like just defence splitting. Like, there was a couple against Coventry and a couple against Watford he did, where they should score because he's just absolutely just sliced them open. It's like a 17-year-old kid. Like, yeah. If you're coming up against him, you'd be like, nah, be sound. Yeah, he's only a kid. And it's like, he's just going to absolutely wrench it. And it's like, it is promising, like, especially with our front three quite aging now, all getting towards 30. Like, having someone that in reserve in the future, he's going to be world-class, isn't he? For me, anyway.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, maybe in a few years, someone will get this clip of us saying this, and, maybe football's a bit like that, isn't it? It might play it out differently, but I think all the tools are there, 100%. I think he's got the talent to be, and the application and the sort of the level headedness to be a world class player. He's different to Salah. He's not got quite that sort of searing pace, but his ability to pick a through ball is sort of Coutinho-esque, and you know, he's more of that wide playmaker. You know, you even saw in that commentary game, he ended up going on to the left-hand side as well, and showed his ability to sort of sling some absolutely beautiful crosses in. You know, they're not even crosses, they're through balls from wide. It's so accurate, and yeah, it's just a fantastic player. And I'm really looking forward to sort of seeing how he develops during his year at Blackburn, and sort of really excited to see him back at Liverpool almost, because I just think he's going to be massive.
Yeah, and I think he could, like you said, if Shaqiri would have moved on, he would have been in and around the squad. He might have played tomorrow, mightn't he? Like, there's games where you thought, oh, this would be perfect for Harvey Elliott, and it's probably better for his development, isn't it? Like, going out on loan, like you said, it's gonna do him wonders. But we've got a couple of questions today before we let you go from Twitter. This first one is from the Cop On podcast. He says, has it got harder and harder to find out transfer news from within the club over the years? It seems that journalists are just as in the dark as the rest of us these days. I suppose it's a good thing, isn't it? Because we don't want leaks. And like, look at the Fabinho transfer, where no one had a fucking clue, and next minute we signed them. So
and Jota as well.
Yeah, and Jota. So do you think it's harder now, Dave, in terms of getting news like that?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, I still worked for the club when the Fabinho news came out, and to sort of give you an insight into how, you know, in the dark everyone was about that fact, is that I was on my way back from Kiev, having covered the final for the official website, and then it was basically news to me that night that it was going to break. You know, I got a couple of hours before it sort of came out, got told that that was happening, so we had to write some stuff or whatever and push some stuff out. So that shows you how sort of quiet they kept that. That was incredible. And I think that's sort of a new thing that's come about in the aftermath of the Virgil van Dijk thing. I think it's a bit... So then when I left the club and came out to being a journalist outside the club, it's not made it particularly easy. But, you know, I still think there's scope to break stories there. I think, you know, people talk about it like, you know, journalists don't get these stories at all. But the fact is that a lot of the stuff that has happened over this summer, you know, Jota is a good example of one that was, you know, completely out of the blue. But a lot of the stuff that journalists have actually been across quite a bit of it, you know, sort of aware of what was going on. So, you know, and I know that James Pearce was the one who sort of first broke that Thiago definitely was going to come. It was happening. The signing was close. So, you know, I don't think we've quite reached a point where we're pointless. But so we do get the odd story from time to time. But yeah, no, I think it is harder. I think that's a fair point to make, particularly on transfers. So a lot of my focus is on getting stories about other things, like injuries.
I think it's a good I think it's a good thing though, isn't it? Because you know, when you are heavily linked with a player for a long time, other clubs can come in for, you know, in the media, you know, such and such a club's coming, which then can have an influence on the price. It can then influence the club who's first in line for him to push for it a little bit harder. And it can sort of be a negative thing, can it? Because remember when the Thiago thing, it was happening, then it wasn't happening, then Manchester United were supposedly going to get him, and then it went quiet again, and then all of a sudden, you know, we got him. The same people that were saying it wasn't going to happen, the same people that said that it did happen. And I think for me personally, I'd rather the club do it the way Fabinho happened, the way Jota did, just all of a sudden you wake up and go, bang, the transfer's happening. It's the best way to do business.
Yeah, I think you can see the negatives in it in terms of looking what United were like around Sancho this summer. They sort of basically, it seemed to me from the outside, that United were basically offering a running commentary on that to journalists who were close to the club. And I don't think that did them any favours, because ultimately they just, you know, wound the fans up into, you know, and then nothing happened. So, you know, it wasn't worth them doing that. They just sort of pushed expectations up and then didn't live up to them. So yeah, I think the way Liverpool go about it is probably very sensible, even if it can be a bit frustrating at times as a journalist. You know, I suppose our job is just to get whatever stories we can, and sometimes that's not about transfers, and sometimes, you know, you do get one, you manage to dig one out eventually. But yeah, it's not easy for us, but I think it is sensible for the business and the way that the club is run to go about that sort of business quietly, definitely.
Yeah, and especially the age of Twitter, like you look at the likes of Nabil Fekir and players like that where it's just long, protracted, and you're just like, I'm bored of this now. Like, you're bored of Fekir's name, and you're not even bothered by the end of it if it doesn't sign, because you're like, I don't care, I'm sick of it, hearing this fucking name.
Dave, you were working for the club when the Fekir thing happened, didn't you? I mean, was you in the room when he had the Liverpool shirt on and everything?
No, fortunately not. I wasn't that close to that one. But I know that the mood was like around Twitter at that time, and it was that move had sort of been followed through the press, hadn't it, and been talked about so much. And then obviously in the end, it falls through for whatever reason. And you know, it just created so much expectation, and then you get that disappointment after. And I think that's hard. You know, I think clubs are learning that's not. It's just not good to do your messaging in that way. It's just try and keep it as quiet as possible. I think it helps the Liverpool as well, is that you've got a really settled group of people who are involved in transfers, and it's a very small group of people who need to know about that stuff, and they're the ones who do know about it. And you know, it's got a tight group that doesn't sort of take information out, which is it just says a lot, I think, about how professionally Liverpool's run, and that's from the football side through to everything else as well. It's just, yeah, fair play to him. I think, like I said, it's frustrating for us, but it gets the job done. And I think that sort of, you know, being that way in negotiations also is quite handy, because I think a lot of clubs respect the way that Liverpool go about the business and know that there won't be this commentary going on in the press while it's ongoing. So, you know, that makes deals easier to do, definitely.
Yeah, man, that feeds into the next question from Owen, really. He says, do you think we really need a new centre-back in January, seeing that the last two games since Virgil got injured, we've won them, and man of the match was Fabian Gomez at centre-back? I love Mata, but with his injury record, would it be better maybe as an option to sell him next summer to partially fund the move for Upper Meccano?
Yeah, I think they need one in January. I think they need bodies. I think you can't rely on Matip staying fit. And although Gomez has been quite unfortunate in the types of injuries he's had, they've been more impact injuries than sort of, you know, persistent muscular issues and stuff like that. So I think he's been unlucky, but I do think they need a body. The one thing I can say is that I don't think they'll rush to sign someone who's not a good long-term fit. This is not the way Liverpool is run. They'll know that it'd be better if they did get someone in January, but they're not going to sign someone who's not going to be at the club in 4 years' time, or they don't envisage having that future there, you know what I mean? I think unless it's a convenient loan deal they can do or something like that. But, you know, the amount of world-class centre-halves who are going on convenient loan deals in January are probably very far between. So I think, you know, if they can fill that long-term need, and maybe does Matip's future does come into that consideration if he continues to struggle with injuries, then I think they'll do it. It's just, you cannot offer guarantees on whether they're going to sign someone or not, because it's such a long time to go between now and January. And also, you know, that's going to be a difficult deal to do. So it really is, a lot is up in the air at the moment.
Yeah, and it's like, I mean, that would be like a dream sign, like Upper Meccano. I think he's only like 21, isn't he? Like, you can tell he's going to be great in a few years, even better than he is now. And there's like, so like Ben White as well. There's players like that where, like you said, Klopp's not going to make a sign just for the sake of it. He's going to look at it as in terms of he wants it for future. He's not going to just make a stopgap signing like some clubs do, where they go like, we'll have him for a year and then get rid of him and bring someone else. And he wants someone to come and to have a gradual process. So is someone like a Ben White maybe a more viable option, do you think?
Yeah, I think the difficulty there is the amount of money that Brighton would ask to give up Ben White in the middle of the season. He just signed a new deal, which obviously all that speculation that was around him, he had 2 years left in his contract then, and they wanted around 30 million. We're obviously going to be way beyond that if Liverpool come for him. Another one, you know, he's another one as well. I'm not sure, is he the right profile in terms of, you know, I know they did track him over the summer, and there was sort of initial contact with his agent, but it didn't really go much further than that. And I'm thinking, if it is someone who's going to come in and sort of they want to replace and challenge Van Dijk, he's got a very specific profile in terms of his aerial prowess, and that profile's not perhaps matched by either Gomez or Fabinho. So, you know, Ben White doesn't really fit that. I don't think Upper Meccano fits that. So it's, you know, I could really see them, if they do go for someone, it being someone that's slightly more left field, someone we've not really sort of talked about yet or thought about. Because that's, you know, a lot of Liverpool signings are like that. And they do need someone if they're going to bother to, you know, if they think that short-term losing Van Dijk for this period of the season is going to be so damaging, I think they'll go with someone who's as similar characteristics as possible. So I'm massively aerially dominant, who can pass the ball as well as that. Unfortunately, there's not many of those about, but you know, you back this scouting team to find one over probably any other club in the league, because they've picked out gems time and time again.
Absolutely, mate, you're spot on there. And I think even if, playing devil's advocate, even if we don't get anybody in January, we've got to sort of like, which I agree with you, Dave, I think we definitely will, but there's always that risk that doesn't happen. When we remember last season, you know, we didn't strengthen in the summer at the beginning of the season when we won the league, and everyone was just going on and on at the club for not signing, not strengthening, not adding to the midfield like we should have done, and everyone said we weren't going to do anything. So you never know what happens in football, do you? We might end up not needing one, of course, anyway. But listen, Dave, we want to say thank you very much for joining us tonight, mate. We really, really appreciate it. Obviously, one more time on here gets you your very own Kopite hat-trick ball. So make sure that you're on a little bit earlier than
yeah,
one time. So we'll get your hat-trick
ball. Now, it's the second show now.
Make sure you guys who are watching, make sure you follow Dave on Twitter, because he writes some awesome pieces and it's all Liverpool based and it's absolutely fantastic work that he's done. Let us know in the comments what you think about the VAR issue. Let us know who you think we should be signing in January, if anybody. Let us know how well Dave's done on the show once again. Let us know how good looking Mick is, and wish me an happy birthday, and we will see you next time, won't we, Michael?
See you in a bit.
Podcast Network.